You're listening to Autumn on the Air, the weekly podcast that brings you conversations about the impact of research commercialization and the people who make it happen. Join us for interviews with patent and licensing professionals, innovators, entrepreneurs, and tech transfer leaders on the issues and trends that matter most. Keep listening for an inside track on the people, IP policies, and politics changing our world.
Hello and welcome, everyone, to another exciting episode of Autumn on the Air, where we delve into the world of innovation, technology, and the ever-evolving landscape of knowledge transfer. I'm your host, Lisa Mueller. Our guest today is Leah Spieser, a seasoned expert in technology transfer and commercialization, currently serving as a senior consultant for knowledge transfer and commercialization at the Research and Innovation Foundation of the Republic of Cyprus. With a rich background spanning academia, industry, and international development, Leah brings a wealth of experience and insights to the table. In this episode, we'll be diving deep into early stage technology acquisition opportunities. From understanding what types of technologies industry partners are seeking to discover and the best strategies for contacting them, Leah will be sharing her insider knowledge and practical advice to help professionals navigate this exciting space. Welcome, Leah. I'm so excited to have you here on the air.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, we have a lot of ground to cover today, so let's go ahead and get started. And I thought maybe the best place to start off with was to ask you if you could provide some insights into the types of technologies that industry partners are typically seeking when it comes to early stage technology acquisition opportunities.
Well, that's either a very complicated or a very simple answer. So yes, Let's start with the very simple answer. They want ones they can make money off of. That is why they are called for-profit companies. If they don't make a profit, they go out of business. So in order to make money off of things, you need a couple of things. First, it has to fit with your product and service portfolio. The second thing is the company has to have absorptive capacity in order to bring the technology in. And a key part of that, depending upon what they're doing, is either R&D, in applied R&D with like an SBIR company that spins up technology, or new product development. And the final thing they have to have is a way to exit, either by selling a product or good or by licensing. So if those pieces aren't in place, they're not going to be interested at all.
Now, Leah, I know you have a lot of experience when it comes to early stage technologies. And what are some of the effective strategies that professionals can employ to identify some promising early stage technologies for acquisition?
So when we're talking about professionals, I think for your listeners, the most useful thing to do is talk about what a university tech transfer would highlight as opposed to what a industry would look
for. Definitely.
Okay, just wanted to confirm that. So there is a tool that's called a technology roadmap. Roadmaps are typically developed by government agencies, industry associations, things like that. They're relatively authoritative. So you want to find a roadmap, and then you want to do a functional decomposition of the technologies there and figure out how you fit into the roadmap. That's one way that you can do it. Another thing you can do is you can go to industry trade shows. One of the weaknesses in our communities, we tend to go to our own shows and not the customer shows. But if you go to the customer shows, the industry trade shows of the areas you're interested in, you'll find out what they are looking for and what they're interested in. When I was with NASA as a contractor for Goddard, I was involved in bringing a lot of space mapping, mapping the Earth from space technology and sensor technology out of Goddard into precision ag. And the way I got to do that was I went to ag conferences and made presentations on behalf of NASA, and people would come up to me and tell me what their needs are. So by listening to the customer, then you learn what they're interested in. I'm affiliated with, I started a company called Foresight Science and Technology. We're a very successful contracting firm. A number of your listeners will be familiar with us. You hire a consulting group like us or somebody else to help you. That's another solution that you can do.
So, Leah, how does the landscape of early stage technology acquisition differ across various industries? And what are some of the key considerations professionals should keep in mind?
Okay, a couple of things very simply. Again, these are complicated questions that I'm oversimplifying answers for. The first is the difference between deep tech and everything else.
Yeah, definitely.
Deep tech takes long investment periods, so it's treated differently than short investment periods. That's the first thing to think about. The second thing that you want to think about is the path to the end user. How long is this supply chain, value chain that you're inserting into, and where are you inserting? Because ultimately, the only money in the whole system comes when a consumer or an end user picks up that technology and uses it. So you want to, in a sense, look at that industry and backward chain from the ultimate customer who actually puts the money in up the supply chain to figure out the insertion point, and then you can figure out how to pitch them and what they're interested in.
Now, one of the things that's really important in tech transfer is collaboration. And I wanted to ask you about the role that collaboration plays in the process of early stage technology acquisition. How can professionals leverage partnerships to enhance their acquisition efforts?
Well, that's a good question. There is a book I would recommend to everybody. I have a book out there. Mine's very good, but partnering.
Please do share that as well.
Yes, it's called The Art and Science of Technology Transfer. But there's a very brilliant man named Ron Adner up at the Tuck School of Management. Comes out of industry, writes a very nice book in the sense that it's short, doesn't repeat a lot. You know, and he has two out. One's called The Wide Lens, which is on how you innovate successfully. He's just come out with a newer book called Winning the Right Game. And it's about how you work within an ecosystem and how you partner within an ecosystem. So with that introduction, I'm going to use some of Ron's concept. Ron says, if you think about the value proposition for the ultimate customer that you're selling to, you have to say, how do I actually deliver that? And that's called your value architecture. It's different than the value chain, if that's a term you're familiar with. So the value architecture is the experiences that you provide to the customer so they can reap the value that they're seeking from your technology. So the partnering comes in with how do you create the value architecture? Some of it you can do yourself. Others of it you're going to need to partner for. So, for example, let's say you're doing a spin out at your university and you've sent the faculty through iCore. So now they say, oh, well, there might be a customer out there. I've done the iCore thing. And they're like, okay, I'm going to do a spin out. Well, maybe not. So, for example, do they have the right people in the company? If not, they're going to have to partner to get the right people in the company. Another factor is, do they know anything about new product development, because in theory, that's what you're supposed to be doing when you're doing a spin out in SBIR, is developing product if you're going to go after SBIR money. So if you don't know how to do that, you're going to have to partner to bring those capabilities in. So that's just a rough example of, you know, sort of the partnering example. If you are in the old days when we were starting this tech transfer business, there was a lot of licensing to pharma and big companies. Nowadays, big companies tend not to license. They want you to license to somebody who matures the technology, may introduce it into the market, and then they'll come and grab it.
Yeah, they want to de-risk the situation.
Yeah, so they're de-risking. Also a partnering kind of situation. So, you know, partnering becomes a critical element in all of this. And the other aspect of partnering that's very critical that I think we fall down in our profession is we don't partner internally in our universities and our organizations. So I used to be the director at the University of Rhode Island. Then I was at King Mongkut's University of Technology in Thamburi, which is part of Bangkok, where I was a special assistant. I was senior assistant to the president of the university or some title. I can't remember. But one of the things I did was I pulled the tech transfer office together with the alumni office, because often the alumni are people who can license or you can work with. And I also pulled it together with the people who did the recruitment fairs for industry, because if somebody's showing up to a recruitment fair, They're interested in your students. And if they're interested in your students, they're interested in what you're teaching.
That's a great point.
So why don't you go after those people? So there's a network in the university we don't tap into very well. And that's the other kind of partnering I want to emphasize.
Yeah, that's a really great suggestion and something that I've not really heard before. And I want to continue on and ask you about if you could share with us any insights or lessons learned from all your experience in facilitating early stage technology acquisition opportunities.
So I like to do this with little sayings. So if anybody's heard me lecture, they'll recognize some of these sayings. The first thing is we need to recognize what our business is about. And there was a famous vaudevillian comedian named Milton Berle.
Yes.
Oh, well, you've seen Milton Berle. If you see old TV shows, you see him.
Yes.
Anyways, Milton Berle used to say, if opportunity doesn't knock, build a door. So we must be in the door building business. That's the first thing. My dad, I'm a seventh generation entrepreneur.
Seven generations in your family? That's pretty impressive.
Yeah, my son is going to be the eighth generation. He's coming in to take over Foresight. I retired a number of years ago. Somebody else was running it. But my dad used to say, nothing happens without a sale. Again, in the tech transfer business, it's all about that sale. And in order to get that sale, you have to say, where does the customer I'm going to get that sale? The person I want to license to. So if we have time, I'll give you a quick story. I was doing a dental radiation shield, because it turns out the major cause of mouth cancer is dental x-rays.
Yes, it is. Yep. Yeah.
Wow. So a professor at Storrs, Connecticut had invented a little thing that went in the bite wing. So you're going to take, you know, the x-ray and they put this thing in your mouth and you're talking like this and it hurts while you're going down. And then there's a target that the x-ray machine goes through. So she invented putting a shield that narrowed what came through the target so it only hit the parts of your mouth that they were interested in. So how do you license this? So what I did was I went and figured out who sells to dentists. And that's a company called Henry Schein. There's a catalog company. So I called up the buyer at Henry Schein and I said, would you be interested in this? I know you're not going to license it, but would you be interested in it? And they said, well, tell me more. I told him, he said, I'll tell you what, we have a panel of dentists that we work with when we bring new products and send me a couple of samples and I'll see if they like it. So it's a retrofit to the bite wing thing. So I sent him a bunch of them. He liked it. He said, that's pretty interesting. So yeah, we would be interested. I said, great. Who would you like to buy it from? He said, there's this company in Germany. There's a company in France. Here's where we buy our bite wing stuff. I called them up and I said, could you tell me who you buy from? He said, yes, here's the name of the people. Can I use your name? Yes. I called him up and I said, this guy at Henry Schein wants to buy this from you. Are you willing to license it from us so you can sell it to him? Guess what the answer was?
I would say yes.
Bingo. So you get the idea. That's nothing happens without a sale,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
And the third thing I would give as a tip comes from, I'm trying to remember his name. Maybe it was Mark Spencer. He was a tech transfer person at UT Austin. And he said, the magic's in the know-how. So yes, the patent's lovely and all these things are lovely. But if that faculty member isn't engaged or that researcher's not engaged, nothing is going to happen with an early stage technology. You cannot move it. Finally, I used to make up quotes and put them on the Autumn list server with these incredibly bogus footnotes. And
oh, really?
It's interesting. Nobody ever caught it. And I had one quote that I attributed to Benjamin Franklin. It was like from the Undiscovered Parts of Per Richard's Almanac, you know, published in 1922 by somebody I can't remember. And the quote was, it is a poor merchant that blames his customers for his problems. I'm going to repeat that. It's a poor merchant that blames his customers for his problems. Now, ask yourself how many times you've heard a tech transfer person complain about industry.
It happens pretty regularly.
So that's my last tip. Just remember, they're the customer you're selling. So you have to think about how do I make this attractive to them? How do I make this win-win? So on and so forth.
Those are some really great tips. And you know your secret's out now about your bogus footnotes, but
I have many secrets, so it's okay.
Okay, you have more. Maybe we'll get a few more out of you.
Yes, you'll get a few more probably.
Before the end of this podcast. So, Leah, I wanted to ask you, how do organizations ensure that technologies they acquire align with their broader strategic goals and objectives?
So, again, if you're looking at it from the industry side, there are new product development portfolios, and you want to understand that new product development portfolio. One of the things you can do, particularly if it's a public company, is you can look at SEC filings, and they will put information there. You can look at annual reports, a variety of other things. You can look at, I know a lot of people are big on patents, looking at patent landscaping. I'm not quite so big on patents for various reasons we can go into, but it is a tool nonetheless. Co-publications are clearly important. When we're looking at it from the university side and we want to align, you really want to, there are two critical factors. The first critical factor is getting senior management involvement. If you can't talk to senior management, you'll never align. The second critical factor is developing a balanced scorecard. So these are not single metric things. It's not just money. It's not just impact in terms of jobs or number of spinouts. There's a variety of factors that are important to universities. And you have to think about that range of factors and structure what you're doing in light of that range of factors. And that's a balanced scorecard.
So I want to turn back to something that you just mentioned, and that's IP. And I wanted to ask you two things. First of all, what role does IP play in the process of early stage technology acquisition? And how do you think professionals can navigate IP considerations effectively? And then the second part of that question is, I'm curious about the point you just made about not being big on patents. And I'd really like to hear that perspective as well.
So let's break it down. IP only matters with deep tech. So if you think of software, you know, by the time you're ready to, it's easy to design around. So you get copyright. It's harder to patent in many jurisdictions. And the time to market's pretty short. So and the churn is short. So a big factor is what's the rate of product replacement or the churn.
It's a huge issue, yeah.
Whether it's even worthwhile. That's the first thing. So deep tech versus other things. Clearly in deep tech, it's critical because of the size of the investment and the length of the investment. And others, so on and so forth. And then there's what I call small tech, by the way. And small tech is, there's a ton of these things we see in tech transfer offices that are interesting inventions. When I was at URI, we have a big maritime program, and there was a little device that you could clip to a whale's ear, and it, when it would surface, it would go ping and hit a satellite, and you could track them through the Pacific kind of thing. And it was a market of maybe 200 a year.
So I was going to say really small market for that.
That's what I mean by small tech. Yeah. Easy, you know, it's an interesting, clever device. And you might as well just do that and make it yourself and sell it out of the lab that does it and use it as a revenue center. That's what we did for at URI. And I've seen other examples of what I would call small tech that are, you know, the IP is less important than getting somebody to make it and use it and first to market. Now I'm going to tell you a little story that highlights how you think about IP. I used to be an IP law professor. I've done a lot of different things.
Yeah, you definitely have.
Yes, I've been a man in my life. So I had a friend who was chief counsel for Google. And when they acquired YouTube, I think it was YouTube. I'm pretty sure it was. There was all this stuff about, you're infringing my copyright. You're infringing my copyright. And so he goes in and says, we got a problem here, this copyright infringement. And you know what the senior management said? It's the best thing that could happen. It's so much cheaper than doing advertising to pay these people off. So the point is, IP is a tool. It's a business tool, and you have to approach it strategically. Sometimes it's useful, sometimes encouraging violation is useful. You know, it's a strategy. It's not an end all and be all. What I meant by patents is, particularly in today's world, when we started this profession back in the old days, and I am old, unfortunately, there wasn't a lot of IP on the market. Not a lot of technology coming out on the market. Today, there's a glut on the market. So if you, anything you think of and you start Googling it or doing a patent search, you'll find there's 20,000 typically. I mean, I'm making up the numbers, not literally 20,000, just big numbers.
There's a lot, yes.
A lot of competitors out there. And so the question becomes, what is the value of the patent versus the relationship? Because the reality is, most tech transfer offices lose money. So what we're really good at is using technology to stimulate partnerships with industry for sponsored research, and then maybe a patent comes out that's relevant, but industry is paying for it then as part of the deal. And so you have to think about your own portfolio strategically, when it makes sense to patent, when it makes sense to just use it as trade secret. And people tend to underplay the importance of trade secrets.
Trade secrets are very, very important, and that tends to get lost. And especially I see that in startups where then they file on everything, including their trade secrets, which right. then, of course, then causes them to lose trade secret status. But yeah, and then they find themselves bankrupt.
And then they find somebody's copied it by designing yeah, around
exactly.
also. Or it's the recipe for a new recipe for making urea, and you know, who knows if they copied it or not.
Exactly. So Lee, I wanted to ask you, are there any specific tools or resources that you would recommend to professionals who are looking to streamline their early stage technology acquisition processes?
So there is a process that works well. The first thing is to figure out what your value architecture is. What are you really trying to offer those end users with this early stage technology? And what do you need to create that? The second thing is to develop a business model. It's like business model canvases are used with companies, but you can think of this technology as a single product company in a sense. The third thing to do is look at that business model canvas and do a SWOT on it and say, where am I? What are the strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats? And what do I need to fix? And finally, when you're looking at your process in the university, as you're trying to move early stage technologies out, you want a value engineer. There is a lot of stuff that is done that does not contribute any value, does not make it easier to get it out. And you want to eliminate that because it's just a waste of time and effort.
Now, finally, what advice would you give to professionals who are looking to capitalize on early stage technology acquisition opportunities, whether it's in their own organizations or other industries?
So the best advice I have is to be a trickster. The trickster figure is well known in myth. Raven, Coyote, Anasazi the spider. And if you look at what trickster figures do, is they shake up moribund systems. They do it with humor and levity, but they get things unstuck and then help it rearrange in a new way. That's really at the heart of the profession, is being a trickster. And you just got to do it intentionally, which means you got to get out of your office and meet people where they are and talk to people. And, you know, it's interesting because there's this big flurry of stuff on AI now that you see. And, you know, there is some, I'm not saying there's no utility to AI. I won millions of federal dollars when I was younger as an AI researcher. I was involved in early neural nets. So it's not that I'm saying that they're all bad or anything like that, but they're a tool for early stage market research to get your arms around things. You start getting more and more detailed. You need to understand how ChatGPT and these things
all
work.
All those things work, yeah.
Yeah, and then they'll crash. There's a wonderful little piece by one of the editors of Science on how they work. On that Science, Nature magazine it showed up in. So that's the first thing. The second thing is something I learned in the fire service. I'm a firefighter.
Wow.
And a wildland firefighter. And I'm a member of the command staff on incident management teams. You know, these are the big fires you see when they send in, you know, 300, 500,000, somewhere in that range of firefighters. So I'm on the team that helps manage those. And I'm one of the teams. And then you get assigned to other teams. But anyways, there's a structure called the incident command system. And I strongly recommend that people take a look at what's involved in incident command system. Because the concept there's certain specialized functions. Sometimes you need them, sometimes you don't need them, like air. There are certain teams you bring in that are called strike teams that are a set of engines, typically up to seven, because span of control of 5 to 7 is about the most you can do. But the idea behind the incident management system, it's what FEMA uses also, by the way, it's used around the world now on emergencies, is you have a simple structure that you can build up as time goes on, and it's flexible and it's like plug and play. Well, where we started this part of the discussion, it was like there's no really one industry or one thing, but there's certain elements that are plug and play. So you want to think about how you take these elements and combine them as opposed to get locked into a rigid model. But yet it's replicable because you have a system and pieces that you're used to plugging and playing. So that's the other aspect of this trickster kind of thing, is that you can structure it somehow.
Oh, that's really neat. I've never heard that before. So thank you for sharing that. So Leah, I'd really love to pivot and explore your experiences working within Cypress. And my first question is, you know, you mentioned you were at the University of Rhode Island and then you were in Thailand. How did you even end up in Cypress?
So a couple of things that are relevant here. One is, I was at University of Rhode Island a long time ago. I was working for a company called Foresight Science and Technology that I founded. I retired out of that. I went into forestry, then I went into the fire service and a variety of other things. So in the summer, I'm living in Port Townsend, Washington. In the summer, I am working on big fires. And in the winter, I'm an EMT on an ambulance. And I am the second longest survivor of a bone marrow transplant from Fred Hutchinson. I think I'm the second longest. I'm maybe in somewhere in there. And I am also pushing 70. Well, now I'm over 70. But and I'm working on an ambulance and COVID hits. And there's a shortage of personal protection gear, as you remember.
Oh, yes.
And there's no vaccinations. And I'm carrying 10 people a day in the bus with COVID. And I'm a volunteer. And my colleagues who are professionals are like, you're crazy. You're too old to be here under these circumstances. You need to stand down. But, you know, it's a team and there's a rush in doing it. That's part of being the team. And so finally, the discretion being the better part of valor, I was convinced to stand down and I did stand down and go on leave. And while I was on leave, because I was involved in bringing this profession up, wrote the basic textbook, did a lot of the legislation. SBIR is a bill of mine, Federal Tech Transfer Act, which set up the FLC and the federal lab stuff. I did those by DOE as Joe Allen. I was point person for the budget community, on the budget for the science community also for a number of years. So anyways, I have all these experiences, and then I built a successful company that's raised over $3 billion for customers and stuff like that. And playing around the fire service, and all of a sudden, shoot, what am I going to do?
Yeah, exactly.
I'm sitting around doing nothing. And I get this call out of the blue from, which is how I got to Thailand also, sort of out of the blue. And somebody found me, and it's the Director General of the Research and Innovation Foundation at the Republic of Cyprus, which funds all the R&D, competitive R&D in Cyprus. It's sort of like NSF, NIH, yeah. And everybody else rolled up to one. And he goes, how'd you like to come to an island in the Mediterranean for 2 years and develop a tech transfer program for the country from scratch?
Wow.
Okay.
That's an incredible story. Well, thank you for sharing that. And, you know, given your deep involvement in tech transfer within Cyprus, could you elaborate on some of the distinctive challenges and opportunities you've encountered compared to some of the experiences you've had in other regions?
Sure. So a couple of things to highlight very quickly. First of all, Cyprus had no tech transfer. They had a little bit, but, you know, at the level that we think of it in the U.S. or Britain, And in the EU in general, it's particularly as you get into the southern EU, it's not what we are used to in the United States. Northern Europe is a little different. So that's the first thing. Second thing is Cyprus as a country is very unique. It's a tiny island. There are about 900,000 people in the country, smaller than most American cities.
Yeah, very small.
Yet we have a number of universities, but our first university, State University, University of Cyprus, was founded in 1989.
Oh, it's really young.
Young.
Really, really young.
We have, on the other hand, one of the highest educated populations in Europe. So going to school is important for a lot of people, parents and so on. We have no large companies by global standards. Our large companies are mid-sized companies, even if they are exporting and have factories in other countries. And most of them are family-owned, which makes them innovation-resistant because even if you've gone overseas to school and you're a go-getter, you come back and you come into the family business and dad's sort of like, it's typically males. It's only now that females are coming in. Dad's sort of like, and grandpa's like, that was good enough for us, you know? And so you get those kinds of attitudes that make it very hard. Having said that, the country's at the tipping point. So there's a lot of really smart people. There is a government policy to make it a regional innovation hub. Getting it over that tipping point, however, is a challenge and requires a number of new approaches. And the most significant new approach, I'm sorry for talking so long in response to this. In the U.S., when we did SBIR, SBIR came out of some work I did in the automobile industry, which dealt with how do you spur fuel economy. And then I ran across, Reagan had done, come in, you couldn't do more CAFE standards. And I ran across a small SBIR program set up by Roland Tibbetts and NSF and decided that if we brought this in government-wide, we could shake up the system, bring in some more socially responsible innovation. So we did the SBIR legislation. And that was quite an exciting time in my life. But anyways, as a result of that, we really gave leverage to small research companies. And obviously, they're a key part of our ecosystem together, these spin-up companies. Where we fell down in the U.S. and where the real problem in countries like Cyprus is you don't need research companies. What you need is transition and product development companies. So it's a different kind of company. Yeah, it does a little applied research, but not the kind of, you know, take something at a low TRL, TRL 3 and spin it up. These are people who are starting at like SBIR phase 2 and moving beyond that. And that is an interesting model to think about. And it works very well in as a way for lesser developed regions, even in the U.S. where you're a university or a college in a rural area, or if you're in a lesser developed country like Egypt or Cyprus or Thailand. And I learned this at King Mongkut because people would come to the university because there wasn't a lot of capacity in the country for product development. And they go and say, I want to hire a graduate student and a faculty member, and I need this tweaked onto a GIS system I'm selling. And then they would hire the students and they would go into the company and downstream they would start to fund research. And so what you were doing was not just moving technology, but teams, people with the technology. And that is in effect what we are doing in Cyprus now, is developing a structure where we move teams out of universities with the technology, because there's too many postdocs globally and nothing for them. So we're training them different than they used to get trained, and then moving them into industry with the technology. And we have a number of programs to support them at the foundation, going all the way from SBIR type programs, early stage programs, down to things that help you get Series A funding if you're in that kind of a situation. And of course, our part of it at the foundation, our funding goes way down the farther along the risk reduction goes. But because this is a culture that has not developed absorptive capacity and has not developed an angel community or a venture community, you have to stimulate it by filling in with the government stuff. The difference between Cyprus and the U.S. is in Cyprus, there's a clear need for it because there's a void. In the U.S., we've seen some market distortion because you can have a venture capital backed company and win SBIRs for, you know, so the government begins to supplant the private sector in a sense where the funding is anyways, and you get these SBIR mills that just crank out things and actually don't actually get product to market.
Yeah, that's absolutely fascinating. And I know you've only been there a short time, but are there any success stories or maybe notable achievements in tech transfer that have emerged from Cyprus that you'd want to share with us?
Yeah, I'm going to share a few with you. The first one is there is a faculty member who left on her own, but took her technologies with her, named Mariana Prokopi Dimitriadis. And this is a young woman, quite brilliant young woman, who works in oncology. And she has developed three spinouts doing different drugs and attracted venture capital from around the world. So that's a real success story.
That's a real success show.
I'll give you another example. We're just now setting up the national system, but I was at the University of Cyprus and ran into a young woman who has a technology. She began working on it. It went during a fellowship at Sloan Kettering and then went back to Cyprus and has continued working on it. And it's hopefully the first way of medicinally curing a triple negative breast cancer.
Oh, which wow, would be huge.
25% of all cancers are triple negative, and it's basically lop off a breast, which is relatively harsh. So you can appreciate the importance of that. Now, this is now going through our process in Cyprus, but that's a very exciting one. We also have these EU partially funded, government partially funded centers that are called centers of excellence. One is the Cyprus Maritime and Marine, or Marine and Maritime Institute. And I'm a former sailor, so I grew up on the coast. And so I have kind of a love of that kind of stuff. And they have developed an artificial reef. Now, you see people who make artificial reefs and they take concrete blocks out or they sink ships. What they do is these are applied research organizations. So they've taken a laser to map a reef. And then if you've ever seen these giant inkjets that print houses out of concrete.
Oh, yeah. I've seen those, yeah.
Well, they're printing reefs with the exact structure of the reef. So it's replicates the habitat much better. And then the key innovation in this, that's very clever. But the other thing is they figured out how to combine in the cement chemicals. So they can put in chemicals that repel predators and food for the fish you want to support.
Wow, that's
and the coral you want to support to make it easier for them to survive. And they can take this, for example, in the Pacific Northwest, when you take down a structure and you're going to rebuild a wharf, you have to think about how do I reseed the eelgrass? Well, if you use their cement to make the pillars, they can seed the eelgrass and nourish the eelgrass out of the
really
pillars.
That's really amazing.
So that's very cool. I will give you one other example because I know we talk more about the social sciences and humanities now. So at the European University, there is a Center of Excellence in Risk and Decision Sciences, CERDES, which is very near and dear to my heart. They're a first responder institute. And they have been developing training methods that enhance exercises to make them more realistic and to allow, because when you're fighting fires in Europe, you're not only taking people from different states, but different countries with totally different systems and how to integrate these and that kind of stuff.
Oh, that's
really
neat.
So they're working in that area. So that's an example from the various public universities, private universities, centers of excellence.
So that was really interesting. And I wanted to ask you next, how does the Research and Innovation Foundation of Cyprus support technology transfer efforts within the country? And what impact has it had on the local innovation ecosystem?
Well, the impact, I'm going to start with that, is mostly at the level of awareness in early stage because we just started this. We have developed a national system that is a hub and spoke system. The hub is the central knowledge transfer office. The spokes are in all the universities and the research institutes and the centers of excellence. So the primary function of the spokes, because there's not a lot of capability in the country today, is to develop IP policies, develop patent budgets for their institutions, actually appoint somebody as a knowledge transfer officer. We use the term knowledge transfer in Europe, which is ironic to American ears because when you educate a student, it's knowledge transfer. But anyways, they call it that there. And so so we have these in the spoke, and they do the in-reach. And we're training them on how to do in-reach. The central office does what you would think of as a KTO doing in the U.S.? Because it's a small country, it makes sense to centralize those functions in a central office. And so the system was brought up about 8 months ago. So it's still a very young system. And now there's another piece that goes with this, which is I run another program called Innovation Factory, which is where we're training industry. Because you can't have a tech transfer. You could transfer it to Northern Europe, but it doesn't help the country, particularly in terms of generating more robust companies for Cyprus, unless the companies know how to deal with it. So we are also training companies in how to bring technology in, how to do the absorptive capacity, how to do new product development, and all these other things. So you have to bring both sides up simultaneously. To give you an idea of the challenge in doing this, one of the things I forgot to mention before is there's not a single patent agent in the whole country.
I was going to ask you about that, yeah, because I know there are some other countries around the world where there are very few to none, either patent agents or patent attorneys. So,
yeah, and the law schools really don't even teach it. It's a module in a course. A lot of trademark registration kind of stuff is what they primarily do as an IP attorney. So we have to also train the legal community. We're developing an angel venture community. So we're working the whole ecosystem simultaneously. What makes it possible for us to do that is we're the national funding agency.
That definitely does help. And I'm curious, Leah, you're mentioning all these programs and all these things you're doing. Besides you, how many people are in your office?
In my office, it's me.
I do all this.
We are an 80-person organization.
Okay.
I have told the director general that, you know, I'm getting a little overloaded. So,
I would say so based on everything you've described so far.
I'm getting an assistant, but it is somebody from elsewhere in the foundation. I can't hire in because there's a hiring freeze going on. So, we have that. The other thing that we're doing, I'm just going to make a quick pitch here for your listeners, is for all the people in the spokes, we are working to get them RTTP certified.
Oh, that's great.
So yeah. I am a big proponent of RTTP. I was on the board of Autumn when we endorsed the RTTP and the CLP, but I particularly like the RTTP for tech transfer people. And I think that the certification process is probably the best way to develop your potential as a career person. So I urge everybody to get involved in RTTP.
So going back to Cyprus, what would you say, Leah, are some of the key sectors or industries in the country that are ripe for tech transfer and innovation? And how is the foundation addressing those?
So we view it a little bit differently. So we don't really think of it in terms of sectors that are ripe. We are part, because we're technically a private foundation, but all our money comes from either the EU or the government. And our board is appointed by the chief chair of the board is the chief scientist appointed by the president of the country. And then the deputy minister for research, innovation, and digital policy appoints the rest of the board. So that makes us quasi-government. So our job is to implement the country's strategy. And the country has strategic areas. And so we put an emphasis on our funding and our commercialization. We service everybody, regardless of where they are. But we do encourage people who receive first of all, if you receive our funding, you have to go through our knowledge transfer system. So everybody goes through it. Secondly, we put a lot of emphasis in our outreach to industry on these sectors that are important for the country. So we have programs directed at the marine trades and shipping. We're a big shipping center, being an island, and a lot of global fleets are headquartered there. We have a big emphasis on tourism. We're the Florida or Southern California of Europe. So, you know, we have technology going into tourism, a lot of software.
Makes sense.
And stuff like that. A lot of agriculture as well.
So are there any specific initiatives or programs at the foundation that are aimed at fostering collaboration between academia, industry, and government for tech transfer purposes?
When you look at Europe in general compared to America, consortia or consortium are very important. So a lot of our programs our consortium programs, a lot of the Horizon Europe programs are consortium programs. We have specific programs. Remember I told you about this Move People into Industry. So we have a PhD in Industry program that we fund where you work for a company, you're working on a project for that, but that project is being done at the university as part of your PhD research, and you're building the team and getting other capabilities to bring it in, bring new product development into the company. We have internships for younger students that we do there. As we move farther up, we have programs that are similar to SBIR that are designed to encourage spin-outs and startups, but they also work for an existing company who wants to do a innovative product and it's the first time and it's risky. So if they're collaborating with the university, we have a program called Concept where they can flesh out and see if they can do a breadboard. We have a seed program that allows them to move it forward and so on and so forth. So we have a number of these kinds of programs that are designed to encourage collaborations.
So Leah, how does the foundation facilitate the commercialization of technologies developed within Cyprus? And what role do industry partners play in this process?
So our role is we are the primary knowledge transfer, tech transfer office for the country. So that's a big role, obviously. And now the larger schools, the larger state schools have tech transfer offices, and we don't own the technology. They own the technology. They do the deals. We provide deal support. We evaluate technologies for them, a variety of other things. So anything a TTO does, we do. That's the first thing. The second thing, as I indicated before, is it does no good to have knowledge transfer or tech transfer offices if the ecosystem isn't there.
Right.
So a lot of ecosystem development goes on. It's curious that the U.S. is now in a position where they have to do this, and there's all this NSF money for this. It's also, if you look at this, you know, the problems that you think are only Cypriot problems, well, you look at the ART program for NSF, and, you know, how do you get more translation out of research and research-intensive universities and greater impact. So it turns out these are global problems. So in a sense, Cyprus, from a knowledge transfer or a tech transfer standpoint, is a little experimental laboratory because it's manageable and you can do a lot of really interesting things, particularly because the golden rule applies and we have the gold. So we rule.
That's awesome.
And then finally, when you talk about industry, we have a large generic drug company, a very large one for Cyprus, sells all over the world, has factories in other countries. There's a hematology institute that has a big program on repurposing off-patent drugs for hematological purposes. Neither one picks up the phone to talk to each other.
Really?
And they're in the same city.
That just is mind-blowing.
This is what happens in these countries. And the interesting thing is, think about mid-sized companies in the U.S. and tech transfer offices. You got the same problem. They don't even know they exist sometimes. Of course, the cities are bigger than our country. But so part of our job is to pick up the phone and call them both and bring them to a table, you know, and say, hey, why don't you talk? And I have a number of examples like that where we're doing that kind of work as well. So it's the good news in a country like Cyprus is everybody's about 3 degrees of separation.
Yeah.
It's pretty easy to network to who you want to network to.
Given that you have less than a million people.
Exactly.
It's really easy to do. So Leah, I wanted to ask you, what strategies have you found to be particularly effective in promoting knowledge exchange and tech transfer among the different stakeholders there in Cyprus?
So the most, there's an old adage, tech transfer is a contact sport. And there's another adage, many collisions, minimal friction, that comes out of these advanced ecosystems like the Boston area. And really what you have to do is, part of what you have to do to be effective is you have to create that, because it doesn't happen on its own. We take it for granted in the U.S., but I'm old enough to remember when it didn't happen here. and we had to work to create it. And now you have these ecosystem programs to help create it again and for a new generation in a new way. That's number one. The second thing that needs to happen is we need to recognize that people today exist in a different world than the world I grew up in. And part of this is digital, but part of it is also the way people interact and how they think and how much information they'll take in at one time and all these kinds of things. So you have to sort of, there was a wonderful phrase that Hannah Arendt, the famous German-American philosopher, came up with after World War II. And she said, well, you know, it's like World War II has taught us, because all these civilized people did horrible things, it's like we have to start thinking without a banister. And in effect, in the tech transfer world where we are today, between climate change and global warming and all that, and COVID and AI and all these things coming in, we're back to thinking like without a banister. So when you think without a banister, you have to go back to fundamentals. So what we've learned in Cyprus is you need to go understand the world that people live in if you're going to be successful. And if the problem is grandpa and dad are risk averse, then you have to design a system that they get and they perceive as not risky. You can't just bring in a U.S. system. Now, what's an NDA? What's a material transfer agreement? I mean, those are the same around the world. So there's pieces, lots of pieces, and you know how you walk the halls. Also, disclosures, all these things are transferable, but you have to put them in a culturally appropriate mix. And then you have to add these new elements that deal with the fact that there's a new set of players who are much younger and grew up in different times with different expectations. And the aspect that, of you know, we've fallen down in remembering that it's not about transferring technology. It's about making products that make the world better. And, you know, the Autumn Better World Report is a delightful thing there.
Yeah, it's awesome. It really
is. I wish there was more of that. I wish that we would, you know, stop making skin whiteners and transferring those and things like that, and much more on how do you make it possible for seeds to grow, or how do you make it possible to paint houses so every house is a thermal electric generator and things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, Leah, as a podcast comes to a close, I wanted to ask you, can you discuss any partnerships or collaborations that the foundation has forged with international organizations to enhance tech transfer activities in Cyprus?
Yes, I can. So first and foremost, I want to do a shout out to our colleagues at ASTP. I've been involved in ASTP for a number of years, and they have been very supportive. And so that's the first thing. The second thing that happens is, interestingly, we're getting pretty good support from, which I find personally gratifying, from the U.S. government. There is a U.S., Israel, Cyprus, Greece consortium. I think it's called the three-party agreement. We get some good support out of the EU. For example, my program is funded by the EU. So the European Commission's been very important for us. And we have a special program inside the foundation that supports our awardees in winning additional money from the EU and getting into the EU programs, the larger EU programs. And that includes for people who are trying to spin up technology, you know, and they need that extra set of money that goes beyond what we can do nationally. So we have those kinds of partnerships. The partnerships where you're, you know, we have industry days and those kind of things, we're in the process of developing those larger partnerships. The only other thing I would say is the other group that deserves a shout out is the Israelis. We are an hour from Israel. And there has been a lot of cross collaboration with tech transfer people in Israel and with companies in Israel. And unfortunately, and sadly for Israel, but interesting for Cyprus, is the war has brought a lot more of Israeli tech interest into Cyprus because we're safe being an EU country.
Well, Leah, thank you so much for all your time and this expertise that you shared with us today. Your tech transfer journey has been absolutely fascinating, and you have an amazing amount of experience. So I really appreciate you taking all this time.
Well, thank you very much. And I just want to add for your listeners, if you go to Autumn, you can find how to get in touch with me. But if you do have questions or you're interested in collaborations in the country of Cyprus or talking about things in Cyprus, you can reach me at the Research and Innovation Foundation. My email is lspeser, S-P-E-S-E-R, at research.org.cy.
Great. Thank you so much again, Leah.
Thank you.
And that wraps up another episode of Autumn on the Air. A huge thank you to our special guest, Leah, for sharing her invaluable expertise and practical insights into the world of early stage technology acquisition opportunities. If you enjoyed today's episode and found value in Leah's insights, be sure to subscribe for more engaging discussions on innovation, technology, and the ever-evolving landscape of knowledge transfer. As always, thank you for tuning in. Until next time.
Thanks for listening to Autumn on the Air with Lisa Mueller. Get social with us and share your thoughts. You can tweet us at AUTM or visit us online at AUTM.net. We'll be back next week on the air. Be sure to join us.